From HanselMinutes.com, it's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 218, recorded live Saturday, June 19th, 2010. Support for Hansel Minutes is provided by Telerik RAD Controls, the most comprehensive suite of components for Windows Forms and ASP.NET web applications. Online at www.telerik.com. In this episode, Scott talks with media personality Baratunde Thurston.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman, and this is another episode of Hansel Minutes, and I'm here in beautiful and incredibly hot Washington, D.C., inside the convention center, and I'm talking with the inimitable Baratunde Thurston from, and we're at Blogging Rob Brown right now.
Yes,
We're at the Blogging Rob Brown conference, and you're the web editor at The Onion.
That's
at
America's finest news source.
That's, yes. Our trusted news comes from The Onion.
Yes.
And you do stand-up, and you write books, and you're a personality.
I am me. but I'm here at this conference because I helped start a blog called Jack and Jill Politics, mm-hmm. It's a black political blog. I've hosted a TV show on the Science Channel all about the future of science and tech. I do stand-up regularly. And I'm writing a book called How to Be Black.
Which How to Be Black.
Important guidebook.
Okay. And is this for primarily white people?
This is for everybody, black people and those who love them. So that excludes maybe Glenn Beck, Rush Limbaugh, I'm not sure, but it's a big market.
Okay. And are there any initial tips that our listenership, worldwide listenership, could hear? You know, our friends in Cairo and our friends in Dubai who want to be black, what they can do?
Your global audience, one is to understand that you're going to be called on to be a spokesperson for the race at some point, and how you prepare for that is very important. So you've got to have a tracksuit as well as a business suit that you keep available at all times.
Okay.
Find cameras and mm-hmm. speak into the microphones around them, even if you're not invited. It's very, very important that you always be speaking and have video and audio evidence of that speaking.
Whether it be cell phone cameras or anything.
At this day and age, that will do. Mm-hmm. A big professional camera helps. And have some claim to Martin Luther King Jr. Even if you just like read a book or saw a rally on TV, you know, mm-hmm. if you have some dotted line between you and that figure in the civil rights movement, it really improves your odds of being taken seriously.
You know, speaking of walking around with a camera, when do you think the first time that a cop is going to hit a black person and we're going to have like 720p high quality flip video of that?
Like because, the HD Rodney King.
Yeah, I mean, when is the HD Rodney King going to happen? Because for me,
iPhone 4.
You think the iPhone 4 is the beginning of our first, you know?
Our HD police brutality.
Because I tell you, the cop in Seattle hit those girls, and you know, nobody should hit anybody, but I couldn't see anything. I don't even know what was going on in that picture. It was just completely JPEG'd beyond
belief.
It was
very, very blocky, very low. So we need higher resolution in our civil servant abuse.
Yeah, I think I want to just wear an HD live stream and do the whole Justin.TV thing.
Well, might as well go 3D if you're going to go that far. Get a multi-camera shoot, have people around you to get at least two angles on the perspective.
Or maybe like a matrix rail, you know, so that when it actually happens, I can move in three dimensions.
You could do bullet time, you know, in your abuse situation. This is important stuff.
It's crucial.
Yeah.
Okay, so tracksuit, always be talking, camera, and then always be there to represent the entire race.
Absolutely.
So as an individual, when you speak, you are representing the whole of brown folks.
Yeah, there's like this sort of like always be closing, and Glenn Ross is always mm-hmm. be representing in terms of being black. Like even when you think you're not mm-hmm. on camera and not on a mic, you are. And you're speaking for everybody. So.
Now, what about these white people who say that they have a black card, like John Mayer? Declared that he had a ghetto pass.
Yeah, and then he proceeds to say other ignorant things after to justify.
But he's not the only white person to have done
that. No, we're certainly entering a very fluid cultural time, especially with more media out there.
Right, I mean, representing the entire white race.
Yeah,
on
please,
behalf of
speak
myself,
for white people.
Since I'm speaking for all white people.
Yes.
And you're speaking for all black people. We have a tendency to do that, you know, like the, let me tell you about my black friend, right? I have this black friend.
There's a chapter called How to Be the Black Friend that I'm actively writing right now.
So uh-huh.
I'll be sure to include, you know, some of this perspective in mm-hmm. there. Thank you.
Do black people need white friends?
Yeah, but I guess if you want access to certain areas of society, like cabs, it helps, you know, mortgages mm-hmm. at a reasonable rate. I think we all need friends of different races. It helps all that wonderful stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
I noticed in a meeting that you and I were at in an unknown location that a very nice white gentleman in power, I felt, turned on his black scent. And I wasn't sure. I was like, well, you know, I looked on Wikipedia. He's from Connecticut.
Yeah.
I was like, really? Okay, I guess that's how they talk in Connecticut. And then he said, I'm just trying to keep it real for y'all.
Yeah.
And I said, uh-oh, he just turned on the black scent.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know about you, but race notwithstanding, I can't talk to an Irishman. You know, I had an Irish neighbor, and I mean, you know, he's like, hey, Scott, how's it going? I'm like, oh, make a spaceship and fly away with my lucky charms.
You're
and
like,
I
was like,
whoa,
temperance.
I didn't even know where that came from. Yeah. I mean, how, you know, I just can't talk to an Irish person without doing that. So I don't think it's a race thing necessarily, but I mean, do you find?
It is a cultural phenomenon that is more unique to black people because so much of black culture has become American culture.
Mm-hmm.
You look at jazz music, rock and roll, hip hop. Music is a very powerful example.
Mm-hmm.
Food's a very powerful example. And language is a very powerful example, in part because of music. So mainstream news anchors say, keep it real. Use the word diss. Give shout outs on the Today Show. And it's really awkward, but they're not claiming blackness. They're just claiming coolness because so much of blackness has become cool in the eyes of so many, in part because of music.
But when did being white become uncool? I mean, I feel bad about all the bad white stuff that my ancestors did to y'all. But
would you please say to you people? I think it's better when you say you
people. To you people or your people? Which would be the most offensive?
Oh, you people is much better. Yeah.
You and yours, your people. But honestly, I don't think, I mean, I can accept the white guilt, but I don't think I can accept the white uncoolness.
Wow. This is, okay, so you're going to have to write a book called How to Be White. And then we'll do a companion edition where you buy both editions.
I think it would just be Appendix A of your book.
All right.
I'd be more than happy to write the foreword. That could be How to Be White.
That's funny, man. That's funny.
Do you think that black people have a white scent? Like the white accent?
Definitely. I mean, it depends on your educational background. I mean, there's certainly a satirical, comedic black scent that you hear some comics do.
Sure.
It's more nasal and high-pitched and more clipped.
I'm not really sure where that came from. I don't think white people talk like that at all.
Most white people don't talk like that. But, you know, if you've gone, like I've gone to a lot of private education later in my life, it certainly changed the way I talk, just the people I associate with. You know,
on purpose? I mean, you're not thinking about it. You don't wake up and say, I think I'll talk white today at McDonald's.
No. Maybe I should.
Can I get a Big Mac, please?
No, it's more of like a natural, like, white voice on demand where it sort of happens. So, you know, you're working in like a professional conference room, business meeting, conference call type situation. Mm-hmm. It's going to be different from sort of hanging out at the bar with your friends.
Truly.
And that's true for
everybody.
And
that's true for everybody, no matter what color they are.
Exactly.
But at the same time,
black people are, you know, we stretch more because of the different worlds and how different some of those worlds are in general, right?
Now, that's an interesting thing. Do you think that black people either have or are required to have more elasticity of personality
than
white
people are? Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is where, you know, you hear this phrase, white privilege. We're talking about race now.
I didn't mean to go there.
No,
we're only 7 minutes into it.
But part of the genesis is that is the idea that race is an unconscious aspect of most white people's personality, where blackness is a very conscious aspect of most black people's lives and personality. You're constantly reminded of your blackness through certain areas of society.
Right.
And, you know, historically speaking, you had one way of talking to those who really had absolute power and could use it to crush you and your people. And then another voice around those who were like,
right, exactly.
So that has maintained today to a large degree with a lot of black people. Whereas white people could always just more or less be themselves relative to the space that black people are allowed to be themselves. We all have a professional, personal line.
Right, right.
We don't all necessarily have like an in-race group, out-of-race group line.
Right, right. Yeah. And there's always the juxtaposition between black generational pain and white guilt. And of course, it is generally believed that white generational pain has more legitimacy than
generational
white
pain.
Like you're born and already you have the weight of 400 years of slavery on you. You know, and it's like, You could be born, go to a private school and go straight to Harvard and skip anything, nothing back. No one followed, no one shoplift, you know, no one followed you thinking you're going to shoplift.
Right.
You still get to claim generational pain.
Got it. Yeah.
See what I'm saying?
Yeah. No, it's become part of, for black Americans, you know, it's become part of your cultural identity and that is passed on. In some senses, it's because at any moment there's still this fear and certain reality that these things can be taken from you, or you can be reminded that, you're very successful, but I could pull you over for no particular reason.
Mm.
And you'd have this doubt in your head about
why
this happened.
And that in itself illegitimizes any power that you may have developed.
Yeah.
Right. And then whenever someone famous like Skip Gates, Robert Louis Gates got you know, had a little situation where someone thought he was breaking into his own house.
Right.
And it's like, no matter how high up you get in the halls of power or the halls of academia, we can still treat you like we did in the
60s. And I think that one of the more fun parts of race is that there is a legitimate possibility of some of these things happening. There's also the sort of corrosive power of self-doubt as a black person when you're just like wondering, like, did that person look at me funny because I'm black or because I smell bad? You know,
right.
Like, why did this thing happen to me? And you have so much history pointing to, you know, reason X, but you're never sure. So it's this, the doubting of yourself. It may not have been race related at all, but you're never quite sure. And so that, and that also leads to, you know, some fun abuse situations on your part.
Yeah, indeed.
Where you just blame race for everything.
That's obviously. Well, it's funny that you say that because my wife and I, my wife is black.
Yeah.
My wife and I have this kind of thing where, you know, if something goes wrong, someone cuts us off and we get racism. God, the man will not let me have that parking spot, you know?
Exactly.
Why can't we
you
just
gotta
park?
Have fun with race and racism or it'll
if you don't laugh, it will eat you alive.
Yeah.
Do you think that white guilt, the notion of white guilt is a legitimate thing? I mean, are young, this is not young necessarily, young trustafarians, right?
Yeah.
You know, like, you know, young kids with dreadlocks and a trust fund that are out there, you just that white liberal privilege. But this is just the general idea of like, hey, man, it wasn't me.
Yeah.
I didn't, you know, I wasn't running the ice cream shop with you guys had a sit-in.
And I think the phrase white guilt has been around for quite some time. It's, it's worn. And I don't know if it's very useful in as much as the phrase post-racial is also a pretty useless term.
Yeah, that's
term.
Getting real old.
What I'd love to see, and I think about this whenever I have these kind of questions about trying to see from another perspective, is like, okay, I'm a dude. What is my relationship to women's rights and feminism and the things that happen on the other side of a line that I'm not on the in-group of? So what is my responsibility to fight sexism?
Or disabilities, or anything else. Like any line that I'm not on that side of.
So, it really came to me when I was in a very long-term relationship and my girlfriend, she was feeling quite uncomfortable about walking somewhere at night. And I was like, well, why? She said, well, I didn't feel safe.
Yeah.
I never don't feel safe. I'm physically fit. I have, you know, not too imposing figure. I know how to walk in different types of streets. I don't fear for my public safety ever. And that is a privilege of my maleness that I don't have to think about. And it's a privilege that I don't have to think about it.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
For me to be more sensitive to and cognizant of, you know, concerns of women, I have to actively make it a part of my life and think about it and not just not be bad. So on the white side of this and the whole white guilt thing, it's not so much about feeling guilty about things some of your ancestors may have done to some of my ancestors.
Hey, my people came from Scotland. I don't that's know anything that's about any of this.
Some, because white people have
a
rich and varied history that gets kind of blended in whiteness.
Yeah, exactly.
But, you know, it's like, well, what am I benefiting from? Or what do I not have to think about because I'm white that other people might? And how do I then live a little bit more consciously knowing that?
That's really interesting. Yeah. My wife has made those similar comments because, you know, I was like, I was in New York and I walked from Midtown up to Washington Heights and it was a great walk. I enjoyed myself. She's like, oh, I can't believe you did that. I just have you put it in such an eloquent way. I just can't conceive of a world where I couldn't walk anywhere.
Yeah.
I've walked in, you know, all these major cities in the world. I didn't even give it a thought.
Right.
And then on the way back, like I was going back from Cairo and, I met a woman in Europe who was going the other direction.
Okay.
And I was like, and I found myself unconsciously kind of going, you're traveling alone? Is that a really good idea?
Yeah.
She's going to go backpacking through Cairo by herself. And then I realized that I was kind of being sexist against her just by implying that it was not really cool for her to do that.
Yeah.
That's amazing. You got to laugh about this stuff or you will be eaten alive.
Yeah.
Speaking of laughter, what exactly do you do at The Onion?
So my title there is web editor. My job there, I like to think of it as sort of a grid. I'm responsible for all of the sort of digital expressions of The Onion.
Mm-hmm.
Think of an X-axis, which has our website, our mobile site, our mobile apps on iPhone and Android, tablet apps coming down the line, or tablet experiences, if they're not apps, social media, and it's probably something else I'm forgetting right now. And then on the Y-axis, think of all the editorial production we do. We have The Onion newspaper, we have Onion Radio News, Onion News Network video. We're working on 2 television shows.
Wow.
We've got live event series. We have books that we publish, like Our Dumb Century and Our Dumb World, which is a big atlas. Then fill in that matrix with things, with the audience, with sales, with, you know, the work that we do satirically. It's my job to help think about how are we represented on an e-reader? What does that product look like? What does The Onion tweet? Who does The Onion follow on Twitter? The answer, no one. But that's a conscious choice to stay consistent with all that we've done over the past, you know, 20 to 300 years, depending on how old you think we are.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman from another parallel universe. Got to tell you about some of our things our sponsors are doing. They make this free podcast possible. If you're developing a new line of business application, you've probably tried the latest version of Silverlight. Now you can get even better results by combining the functionality in Silverlight 4 beta with some of the richness of the third-party controls from our friends at Telerik. They're the first vendors to offer native support for the Silverlight 4 beta and their RAD controls. They've got a new Silverlight 4 CTP suite of these controls. They let you tap into the framework's great potential. You get native right mouse click and all the new features of Silverlight. There's 38 controls that give you all these features. You can start building those compelling line of business applications right away. I encourage you to check those products out at Telerik.com/Silverlight. And, you know, thank Telerik for supporting .NET Rocks, supporting Hansel Minutes on their Facebook fan page at Facebook.com/Telerik. Now back to the show.
So that's the voice of the digital onion, effectively.
Oh, I like that.
You like that?
The voice of the digital onion.
You want
onion.
That? You can have that.
Thank you,
I'll
Scott.
Give you that for free. Is there a voice of the onion? Is there like a secret person that we don't know about? Or is it truly a collective mind?
That's the beauty of it. You know, it's the latter. I joined the onion in November of 07, just shortly after moving to New York for the express purpose of doing more creative things. I worked for 8 years strategy consulting around telecom and media and the future of the web, how people are going to mix and match and make media, for big companies. And I do my solo thing on stage creatively, and it's all about me.
Because you do stand-up.
I do stand-up. Stand-up's a very egotistical field, right?
And that's, yes, it does take a certain amount of hubris.
My perspective, my life, you should be shutting up and listening and laughing to what I have to say about me. The Onion is a very opposite sort of creative environment. There are no bylines at The Onion, and the ones that are there are false. It very much is kind of like the world of improv comedy in that it's a group effort. And so the collective is represented, and that's what you join. And I sort of relish the opportunity actually to be on a team. I love myself. I think I'm pretty cool. But I like a lot also being a part of something that's much bigger than any one person could be. So the Onion sort of quote-unquote newspaper has a chief and editor. The Onion video department has a head writer and a head director. But everything you see is a result of, you know, dozens of people being involved in that process and rejecting a lot of bad ideas or just okay ideas to only leave the truly, you know, best ones that are possible.
And is it remote or do you guys work in an office?
We work together in an office. So our tech team is scattered and we have a live IRC channel that everybody kind of reports to as the office every day.
Yeah.
But the writers are, the full-time writers are in New York and meet on a regular basis. We have a field of contributors who work remotely and send things in. That's shorter form. That's for the headline generation and for kind of short, you know, comedic generation. But for the long pieces, that is an in-the-room exercise.
So that's an organic thing. It's a pitch. I mean, and you're acting it out, and there's probably pantomime and jumping up and down, or is it prose?
I mean, it's different processes for video and for the kind of the newspaper content. Newspaper content.
It's a beautiful day here in Washington, D.C.
We're
as
the
fire
city.
Department goes by.
We're in the city. Starts off on a Monday morning with, you know, 500 to 1,000 headlines that have been pitched by the full-time and contributing staff. And a smaller group of full-time people goes through that and culls that list down to about 100.
That means that a lot of funny things are not being said.
That's right. Because you want to, there's a lot of reason for rejection. One of the primary ones is that it's not funny.
Okay.
And a group of people deciding what's funny is a very high bar. You have to make everybody in that room be in agreement. So sensibility, you know, that's a tough line. Also things that have been said before. You don't want to.
That's my question.
Yeah.
What if someone just had a memory, a sense memory? They thought they came up with something completely unique.
Yeah.
But we did that a year ago.
We don't do it again.
How do you know that? You just count on the collective to figure it out.
We still have people who write for The Onion who have been there since almost it started. It started in 1988 at University of Wisconsin in Madison.
That long
as
ago.
A campus paper. It's 22 years old. I think the oldest staff writers we have probably joined around 90. So they've been around, you know, since the beginning. So there's that memory, but we also have a search engine that we use.
You have an onion search engine?
No, it's just on our website.
Oh, okay. I was going to say. I got to go tell the Bing people to watch out because the onion search engine's coming.
Oh, our search engine would wreak havoc on the world in a good way. It's not a bad idea.
Now, I noticed you yesterday wandering around with an iPad and you said tablet experiences
just
now, but you kind of corrected yourself. You said, you're imagining what a tablet experience for the
Onion would be? I am, and the reason I corrected myself is I'm a little worried from a consumer, or let's call them citizens or people. There's another word for them other than consumers that we haven't
the
come up
great
with.
Great unwashed.
Them. Users. Mm. Losers. What have you. And producers and coders that the amplification of our internet experiences is somewhat troubling. Mm-hmm. It's expensive. It doesn't scale. And you end up having to customize so much that it's difficult to apply learning from one space to another. Whereas we have this thing called the internet.
Right. Yeah.
Which is capable. That's kind of what I was going
to. Why would you want an onion app and not simply a custom site they can bookmark or?
Yeah. I mean, there is a financial reason to do that. You know, people have shown a willingness to pay for apps in a way that is not as easily, you know, replicated on the web itself.
But you're basically saying that because the great unwashed will pay 99 cents to get effectively an RSS reader that says The Onion.
Yeah.
Rather than simply going add to home screen and clicking on it, that we will take their money.
I mean, we'll take people's money just because we'll take their money.
Oh, yeah.
But in terms of, I think what, why you also use the word experience because it's not supposed to be just an RSS reader. And on any tablet now, you can go to our website. It looks pretty good. I mean, it looks great on the iPad. I haven't seen a Chrome tablet yet, but I'm sure it'll look pretty good there too.
Mm-hmm.
The real question is, how do you take advantage of the unique properties of these new devices? They have gyroscopes in them. You can touch them.
Mm-hmm.
The screens are larger than a phone, but smaller than a computer, which is this weird, lovely bones in between space where like you're not quite alive.
Plus two charisma for the lovely bones tie-in. I must say, Peter Jackson is.
Yeah. So there are some fun things you could imagine that an iPhone can't do, and that a computer, a full-on laptop or desktop can't do,
mm-hmm.
that a tablet might offer you. And so we haven't made a full decision on how we're going to approach that, but I can tell you that the idea of using the internet,
mm-hmm.
you know, HTML5 and CSS3 and the latest of those standards to create a compelling reading and viewing and listening experience
right.
is great. And then maybe there will be apps around some truly unique experiences,
okay.
you know, gaming experience, something else. But just reading The Onion is probably not something that we're going to keep putting inside of apps and trying to charge for, because that's expensive for us.
Well, and the expensiveness is the thing that bothers me the most. It's that this explosion of screen sizes. I mean, I just got a 30-inch screen.
Yeah.
And now everyone's back designing for 1,024 again. This is just, you know, 8 more sites that I need to write.
No, I mean, it's hard enough trying to support IE and to have
apologize.
Go to, and not all versions, but, you know, 6 is still out there.
Yeah, I know. I'm working on it.
Yeah, good.
I'm working. 9 is going to be pretty hot.
Good. Yes, I like things definitely. That are
pretty hot. So, I was just in Black Scent just went right on there. Yeah, we just holding it down back at the IE team.
I feel you, brother. I feel you.
But the amount of work that's involved, are we at an end point right now, or are we in an intermediate? Are we in a lovely bones place in between the big screen and the small screen? Because it seems like CSS 3 and HTML5 might make it so we could scale sites with one set of markup.
I think we're, it's popular to think and maybe to say that we're in this transition. I think we're actually in a permanent transition as far as technology's effect on pretty much everything we do. But if
right.
you want to talk about, you know, designing experiences for screens or visual access, because it's not just going to be screens, right? We're, the contacts are coming.
Mm-hmm.
The heads-up display augmented reality glasses are coming, and that's going to be a whole nother experience.
And where the hell is my jetpack?
Yeah, well, I don't know. I don't know if we actually want that. With the liability, the traffic jams in the air, like, this is not a good look. If you see how much trouble we're going to have, and you look at the resources that companies have, that individuals have to try to exploit these,
right.
most don't.
Yeah.
Most people aren't the New York Times with an R&D department to try to push, you know, the envelope. If you're a blogger, like people attending this conference, there's got to be a better, more standard way for mm-hmm. these things to scale across experiences.
And you were saying that you recently outsourced your tech stuff anyway because you were getting overwhelmed. I mean, you're a content producer, not a tech guy.
Yeah, and I mean, I've done that in two ways. So on Jack and Jill Politics, I used to be the tech dude for that blog. I did the WordPress install. I did the finding of the host. I did the Discuss install and plugins. And I'm just not reliable enough. I can't get that call or that email at 3 a.m.
because mm-hmm.
I'm doing too many other things. I'm a bad choice. So we found somebody who was better than me,
mm-hmm.
who wanted to be able to play, and he's working with us.
Mm-hmm.
In my personal site, baratunde.com, I used to host that and manage that and WordPress again. I went to Squarespace.
Mm.
because it's just easier. It's a CMS and hosting all, and you know, design kind of all in one.
Really?
And that allows me to focus on the content, which is my core. I still want to keep a toe in tech just because I don't become too stupid.
Yeah.
But I also know that I'm not a programmer. That's not my core competency. Yeah. So as long as I stay smarter than the people I'm around, that don't do tech, there's some value in that. And as long as I still talk to tech people, there's value in that. But I'm not going to be this tech ninja, ever again. Those days are over.
Do you think that the App Store model is gonna scale? I mean, right now it's a mess. Apple always runs around saying we have X number of thousands, hundreds of thousands.
Yeah.
And you know, and the Windows Phone 7's coming out and we're gonna have an App Store and everyone's gonna have an App Store. I can't find a thing on the App Store.
They are horrible, horrible places. I mean, I'm a big Apple fan and I hate Apple as much as I love them. And one of the reasons I hate them more than say a Microsoft, who I've been a fan and a critic of as well, more critic because that's the fun thing to do, is that Apple pretends to have this flawless standard. They see themselves as condescendingly better than everything else that's out there. So when they have a bad experience, that's worse.
Yeah.
Because they've said they only create perfect experiences. In the App Store, there is no way to sort apps by user rating.
That must be by thought. I mean, they think these things out, don't they?
But why would you hide that? They collect user ratings. I want to find the most popular, the highest rated Twitter app.
Yeah. That's a natural. They hide that because the App Store owners know that as soon as it goes down to 3-4 stars, it's over. It's over. Yeah. Everything that you've worked on, it's like these poor video game guys that work for 18 months on some game, but they pour their lives into it, and then they get that 7.9 from Xbox Magazine. Mm-hmm. It's not going to happen for you. Sorry, go home. Goodbye. Try again.
Or
I bet you it's pressure from the app.
It is, and the fact that you have to go to a store to begin with is a very frustrating experience. On Android, you can provide this fancy thing. It's called a URL. Right?
Really?
Universal Resource Locator.
Magical.
And what happens is you post that, like in an email newsletter that you have to maybe hundreds of thousands of people.
So like maybe anywhere the hell you want to?
Right. Like you could put it on this other place. It's called the internet.
Really?
And then people click on it and they can access the content.
So they click on it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And
on the URL.
You connect the user and consumer directly to the publisher.
Yeah.
That's a model.
It's
that
fantastic.
We should try to replicate.
And they don't need an additional layer of software to get there. Just the browser.
We should replicate that, except we should centralize everything.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. And then maybe take 30% just for the.
You create this separate space.
Yeah. Some kind of a mall, like an app
store.
Mall.
No, it's like, I think it's like more of a store than
more
a mall.
More of a store. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So those types of things are frustrating. And I kind of want, and I know they do these things for a reason. They have a particular vision, but there's a certain anal retentiveness to some of this that is unproductive for consumers, for publishers, for developers as well. And the uncertainty around it, you know, creates a weird market.
Well, these are people's lives. I mean, you always hear about the app developer who got their app yanked or the app has been in the store for nine weeks or something
rejected,
like that.
You have to build it before it's rejected.
But you said that you think they have a vision. But for most companies, like for like GE, which is a company I don't know anything about, I'll bet you that their vision is stockholder value.
Yeah.
Make a buttload of money.
Yeah.
Is Apple's goal to make a buttload of money or is it like to build Skynet? I mean, they must have something that's beyond money that they're trying to do.
Well, I think probably Google is closer to Skynet.
Yeah, they have kind of a messianic thing.
And we're all a part of it. Mm-hmm. We're all Skynet, actually. That's the beauty of it. You're Skynet, you're Skynet, you're Skynet.
Right, it's going to be, you know, the apocalypse will be crowdsourced.
Yeah, absolutely. I like that.
You like
that's
that?
The
you
title
have
of
that
a talk.
Too. You like that? I'm going to do that.
You got to give that talk.
I said it here first, so you can't steal it.
No, I will cite it.
You will cite it.
Yes,
thanks.
And link
back. That's true.
Apple's vision, you know, obviously they're in the business of making money, but they also have a peculiar experience that they're going for. And you can see it in the types of apps that get rejected. You can see there's no porn in the store. There's a cleanliness that they aspire to.
That they aspire to.
In their design and in what they allow and disallow that is, you know, a bit, nanny-ish.
I think condescending was the word you went for that I really like because it is a sense that, hey, we
know what's
we
best.
Know better. We know better. Trust me.
No, one of my more popular early YouTube videos is called I Hate the Smugness of Apple because I had a major failure trying to install their software.
Mm-hmm.
And the response that I got from the built-in triggers in the software assumed I'm an idiot. The message boards I went to ask for help.
Oh, yeah.
All those people
the support forums
assumed I was an idiot. And I'm like, no, I know how to use a computer. I've been doing this since I was six. So this is not me. It's you. Like, you're the problem in the relationship.
Right.
And then in the midst of this, I saw one of those, like, get a Mac commercials. Like, I'm a Mac. I'm a PC. Macs just work. I'm like, this isn't just working. And so the crowd reaction was very full of zealotry.
Yeah.
It was very much like speaking out against Allah or Muhammad and finding the reaction to that from other cultures. So that's what I felt from the Apple crowd.
Yeah.
I had a fun time.
Two things that reminds me of. Yeah. I was at the Apple store a couple of months ago, yeah, and it was packed. And there were, you know, the economy was in the toilet, and they announced that the unemployment numbers were over 10.
Yeah.
And I mentioned to the young Apple, you know, hippie chick that worked there, this really is, you guys are so packed. She's like, yeah, it's recession proof. And it's just like the profundity of that. It just hit me like a slap in the face. I mean, you know, she's like, because she just said, it's recession proof. And I just heard, you know, the lemmings will buy anything from us, no matter what you do with, you know.
Yeah.
It was pretty amazing.
She might as well be selling gin.
And then as far as people thinking that you're an idiot, we're working on this thing, me and my minions.
Okay.
The Hansel minions.
Nice.
Thank you. It's the tech support handshake.
Okay.
Okay. This is like when you call tech support and you like, say,
no. I can see this. Yes.
Fizzbin. So the idea, Fizzbin is the code word.
Okay.
And you just don't tell anybody except tech support and smart people.
Dude.
So you call and you say, hey, go ahead and click on the start. And hey, Fizzbin. All right. Check your IP address. Yes. You want to hook up the DHCP and then is your DNS?
I had a Fizzbin moment recently. I have Verizon's Fios service at home.
Yeah, I do too.
I will never move unless I can get that because I'm 35 down and up. And so I can like really do things on the internet now. I called up. There was a major problem. One site was inaccessible and I did all kinds of tests and I called up and I just, it's something I said about, I think it was the way I said the word router. Like, I don't know. There was just something that was like, oh, this guy knows things. I can talk to him like an adult now. And we can have a productive, you know, company customer experience.
Yeah.
And we laughed and we joked about pinging and it was just great.
Did you guys go out for a cappuccino later?
That's beautiful. No. We're going to meet up in Second Life later.
Yeah, that's cool. Baratunde, thank you so much for
taking
the time to meet me here. And it's been a pleasure to meet you. And hopefully I'll see you around.
It's been a pleasure to be a part of Hansel Minutes. And hopefully I'll be a Hansel Minion soon. I like
it. Very cool.
You should be like a big right-wing radio host with these code names you have for your followers.
Them.
Yeah, Hansel Minions.
You should buy gold. Gold is where it's at.
Yes. And water purification systems.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
All right. Well, this has been another episode of Hansel Minutes. And we'll see you again next week.